All right, everybody, we are in Genesis chapter 50. Did you ever think we'd get there? There were times, right? Okay, last chapter in Genesis, we're going to cover that tonight, and some things in this, again, said in this chapter that is very important for us to think about, and then have a little bit of a review over the whole book, and I look forward to some input from you guys tonight about the book and some of the things that we've talked about, maybe that stood out to you guys particularly, I'd be interested in hearing about. Let me think a minute. I don't have any announcements for the congregation this evening that I'm aware of. Is there anything that anybody needs to announce? I typically forget to ask that question until afterwards, and then I think of it, and then half the people are gone. Anybody have anything for the congregation tonight? Okay, very good. Well, let's get started. When you look at Genesis chapter 50, it flows almost directly out of 49, which we did look at last week. And if I had to give a title to this chapter, I would entitle it with this title, The Puzzling But Glorious Truth. And it's all around one verse in this narrative from 49 into 50. And in 50 we have, in 49 we have the blessings of all the sons, if you remember, and each one was a little different. We highlighted a few of those and talked about them. Had a good discussion last week about it. And then in 50, we have the narrative concerning the actual death of Jacob and his burial, his resulting burial in the land of Canaan, where they all left Egypt, and quite a large procession of the children of Israel, as well as Egyptians, went with the body of Jacob to bury him. And where did they bury him? The cave of Machpelah, near the oaks of Mamre, in the field that he bought from the sons of Heth, that Abraham had bought from the sons of Heth. And he's buried there with who? Abraham, Sarah, Rebecca, and Leah were the four that were buried there, and now Jacob is buried there, and he's been gathered to his fathers, or gathered with his fathers. And upon the return from that to Egypt, now with this grand character, this patriarch and this family gone, as is often the case when that happens in families, there's this giant vacuum or giant hole left in the leadership of the children of Israel, because Israel's gone. He's dead. And so what does that cause the brothers to do toward the end of the book or end of the chapter?
They worry about Joseph maybe wanting to retaliate on
them. Once again, this issue of guilt arises. And has Joseph forgiven his brothers? Oh, yes. Remember now, time is going by the time we get to 50 from when they came into Egypt the very first time and he saw them and they didn't know him. And Joseph's attitude toward his brothers is reiterated again here. Number one, that tells us that the motivation for Joseph's forgiveness or his attitude toward his brothers was not based upon anything to do with his father. You know, sometimes you see that in the world, don't you? That people behave a certain way so that they get the inheritance they're supposed to get. If your father's very powerful and you want to have the inheritance and receive something in the will, I got to live the way daddy wants me to live. But when daddy's out of the way, I'm going to take my inheritance and do what I want to do. Sometimes you see that. Sometimes you see other aspects of the of that manifest itself. Oh no, my granddaughter's crying. Crisis. Oh me. It's funny how one little voice can change your life. When you get into this, though, you look at Joseph's reaction again in its reiteration. It shows his motivation is pure in his forgiveness. That's my point. He has no reason not to forgive his brothers if he so chose to take that path. You'd almost understand and say, well, you know, they did so much evil to him. But he does reiterate his forgiveness, and that's what my lesson about chapter 50 really centers on. And he says here, let me see if I have it. Here it says, "You intended to do me harm or to do me evil." You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good. Yeah, Genesis 50 and verse 20. So I want us to think kind of about that a little bit, because that's really, I think, the core, the cusp of the issue that we're to get out of the last chapter in Genesis. And really, when we look at it in a way, we're going to see how this kind of summarizes the entire purpose of the book. God intended it for good, even though man intended it for harm or for evil. In this case, Joseph's brothers. This is a very comforting truth. It's puzzling, but it is likewise comforting. Well, wait a minute. What happened there? Hold on a minute, folks. I lost my notes. I just saw every slide I've made for this entire class. So, okay. So, if we could only make this idea, let me just do it this way. That's the verse I was wanting to get to come up here a minute ago. If we could only get this tenet in our hearts as we live life, we would be so much better off. But sometimes we have a hard time with this idea of forgiveness, maybe more so than other rich truths that we see in Scripture. It isn't impossible. Joseph held this idea of the idea of forgiveness of his brothers as the foundational and sustaining truth for him through all his years in Egypt. Otherwise, he could not have survived the 13 years of isolation. He had to come to grips with this issue of what have they done to me? Why have they done it? Why was it done to me? And he recognizes it's part of God's plan, and he leaves it in God's hands. You know, our headlights only go so far down the road at night when we're driving down the road, don't we? That's all human wisdom does for us. But God knows the entire journey. And we have a hard time sometimes understanding exactly where all this is going to take us. But God knows. Joseph had that mindset and attitude toward his life. In a sense, even though Joseph wound up in prison in Egypt, Joseph never let his heart go to prison. His heart always remained with God. And there's something I think to say for that. Now, Romans 8 and verse 28, "And we know that God causes all things to work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to His purpose." Is that not what we see in Genesis 50 verse 20? Just another way of saying that. We're pretty familiar with this passage in the New Testament, aren't we? Everything works together for those who follow after God. Well, that's how Joseph lived his life. If you want an example of that, just think of Joseph. We have trouble, Larry?
Okay, I think. Okay. It may be on my phone, but I'm making sure you're
okay.
Here.
So as we think about this, then we can have difficulty sometimes storing and this in our heart, like Joseph did, because of pain and our own fears, and they have such power to lead us to doubt. The truth is fine, and we understand it in an academic sense sometimes. But what we have trouble with is when we say, well, that's the truth, and we put a comma in instead of a period. We say, well, that's the creedal truth in what I understand, but what if? And then we insert what happens to me. But what if? You know, that doesn't really apply if it's this big of a problem. That doesn't work for me. And because we can't fit it into the events and or take the events that are happening to us and put it into some sort of a loving pattern or a useful purpose, because we can't reason it out, our weak little hearts tremble and we spend all of our energy wrestling doubts instead of living. And do you think Joseph ever had any doubts while he was in prison? While he was waiting on the butler and the baker? I'm certain he did. But he's just such a grand example for us on how to live and truly live. And so I wanted to share that this evening with us, just to keep that in our forethought. Not only is this a passage that relates so well to Romans chapter 8 and verse 28, think about this a bit. When you work a jigsaw puzzle, let's say of 1,500 pieces, something really big, and let's say you lost the box. You know you've got all the pieces, but you don't have the picture. All you've got are the puzzle pieces. At times, we have real difficulties getting it all put into place, don't we? We start, we find the corners. If you work puzzles like I do, you look for the corners and the edges, right? And you start putting them together. And if you persist, you piece it together. And pretty soon you see, oh, there's a little picture of a boy. And there's a little picture of a sheep. And, oh, there's part of a farmhouse in here. All of a sudden we start getting a little glimpses. We start getting figured out. We relax a little bit, saying, oh, okay, this is going to be doable. What we have to figure out tells us that there is a pattern. And when we get that jigsaw puzzle and we start getting a few pieces put together, what are we seeing? We start seeing there's a pattern to it. It's just not a bunch of 1,500 pieces from 1,500 different puzzles, that there is a pattern here. And in my life, I'm going to be figuring out this puzzle and this pattern all through my life. And I'm going to put pieces in. Now, what do children do sometimes with a 1,500 piece puzzle with no picture? What do children sometimes do? The immature, perhaps. They get frustrated, don't they? That's why they start with 250-piece puzzles that are bigger and easier. They get frustrated and they give up. But the principle Joseph allows us to see here is that if you deal through the frustrations and you deal through it with time, there, you can be assured that there is a principle, or a pattern rather, to what God is doing with us and wants us to see and do. You know, when Joseph was lying in that pit and his brothers were looking down on him, you know, he had to think, what does this have anything to do with me being exalted? Because he'd already had the dreams. And what does his being exalted even have to do with anything? Why me, God? Why choose me to be exalted? And why have this happen? And then all these things are natural for people to see. Well, again, Joseph and his story is a fulfillment that shows us why These things are important. He summarizes for us all the content of Genesis for us, is what I'm trying to say. And that is this. There is a pattern. There is a pattern with God. Now think just a minute. We're in Genesis 50. We've seen through Joseph's almost an analogy kind of a life to that statement, right? A picture of that statement. There is a pattern with God. He has a plan. He's enacting that plan. Step back for a minute. Let's look at the book as a whole. Did this book as a whole not teach us this principle? When you look at Genesis chapter 1 through 3, where it in total entails all of creation being done and carried out, can you say there's no pattern? Even the order in which it was done involved a pattern. And we go through the entire book. It's over and over again, almost on every page for us. Folks, there's a pattern. God has a pattern. God has a plan. God has a pattern. It's following it. And it continues. And that becomes very important as we move further and further into the Bible and into the other books. And it was important for this beginning audience to know that, right? With the books of Moses, Israel needed to understand as a nation that God has a pattern and God has a plan. And we need to follow it. It becomes very foundational to them as a nation. So, it's not only a glorious statement or truth that we see in Genesis. It's also a comforting truth. It's a comforting truth because what it tells us is that there is no enemy that has power over the called of God. Do you see that in the story of Joseph and even Jacob? There is no enemy that has power over the called of God. Is that important for Israel to know at Mount Sinai when they first received this message? Yes, it is. Is it important for us as Christians to understand that message and carry it in our hearts like Joseph did? Yes. You see, these people, they meant death for Joseph, but God used it for light. They meant shame for him, but God used it for glory. They meant slavery for him. Boy, this is just not working tonight. Technology is defeating us. They meant slavery for him, but God used it for power. And this was not only to benefit Joseph, and the young man makes that very clear with his statements to a brother, this was not about me and you. This is about more than me. Because, again, his statement that he believes in is God has a pattern. We're just going to have to quit, I guess. What are we doing, Larry?
Got audio issues. Y'all working on it.
Okay. Y'all have
just
to
keep going.
Excuse
keep
going. Us. Let me get my thoughts. God used their sin to bless many nations. And themselves and the children of Israel as well. The blessings of the brothers had a universal and timeless thrust. This tells us that God works for sinners and causes the wrath of man to bring praise to God. That this is too complex of a matter shouldn't keep us from warmly receiving the truth of it. And the cross is a supreme example or exhibition of that. So, I want us to take just a moment now and talk about any comments in the chapter or concerning this last bit of the book. What is our takeaway from this chapter?
Himself to his brothers, And he immediately says, don't be afraid. Don't feel bad about what you did to me, because God meant it for good. And I'm thinking, you know, all this time he's sort of playing along and he's speaking through an interpreter so they won't know who he is.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he finally reveals himself and he says, I forgive you because God meant it to be this way. And I think, wow, that is really amazing. That I guess God made it clear that there was a plan. I mean, he didn't just like sit there and figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
But then he was so forgiving right away and put them at ease. I don't know if they could take it in, if they could understand.
Well, obviously they had trouble with understanding it because he told it to them more than once.
Yeah.
Said, I've already told you, basically, that God intended this for good, even though you meant harm or evil for me with this. God intended good. And I'm going, and then he adds a statement here in verse 50, chapter 50, we didn't really talk about. He makes an additional statement to that there in verse 20, doesn't he? And basically it's, and I'm going to take care of you. Okay? Now, we've made a reference a few times that Joseph is a type of Christ, isn't he? With what we've been studying, what he is going through. He is a type or forward looking toward Jesus Christ. And when we look at these verses here, is that not exactly what Jesus Christ did? I forgive you. I forgive you. I'm going to take care of you. Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. They don't understand your pattern. They don't understand your plan. They don't see me in that. And yet Joseph could have echoed those same words, couldn't he, with what's happened to him. Joseph, I think, had come to understand this grander mission that God had in his life. And that takes a lot of insight, doesn't it, to see that. Not everybody ever understands the mission that God is acting within us. And sometimes we think, oh, that's nothing, and we set it aside. But it is truly something that we need to consider. Other thoughts or comments on the last part of this, or even the whole book, for that matter, if you'd like to bring something else out. That?
And it's not the end of the story. It's not like, and now, the end of the story, he ends the book by saying, and that's not all.
Mm-hmm.
There's still promises to be fulfilled, and I believe he's going to fulfill them. So, take my bones with you when you go. He's got that.
Yes.
That trust in what's going to happen, not just what has happened and is happening, but what will happen.
Mm-hmm. Remember, we've still got to deal with the promises given to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, don't we? The threefold promise. You've got the land, the nation, and the spiritual blessing to all nations. Have those been fulfilled yet? They have not. Not any of them. They haven't seen the spiritual blessing. They don't have the land of Canaan. And they're not a great nation. They're the guest host, they're the guest of the host nation Israel, Egypt, when we end Genesis 50. Those are three great statements of God that are yet to be answered or revealed in the pattern. I mean, Genesis just kind of gives you the four squares of your puzzle. So it frames it, but we don't know, we can't see any of the tapestry in any of that. And when we turn over to Exodus 1:1 on the very next page in your Bible, when you turn that page, you're skipping 350 years. Okay? And now we're going to pick up some more pieces. And that's where Exodus picks right up and concludes and adds to this story. You know, you've stared at these corners for a while and all these pieces, and it's like, oh, I see a few more that'll fit. 350 years it took you to figure that out. And then man starts putting them in place again. Or God allows it. So maybe that's the way to look at that or frame it. All right, I want to review in the time we've got left the book as a whole a bit. The book of Genesis as a whole is an introduction to the rest of the Bible. Pretty fair statement, isn't it? It tells us where man came from at the very beginning. It tells us about that God has a pattern or a plan and shows how he's going to be implementing it and takes us pretty far down the road toward the implementation of that plan. Several places in Genesis gets pretty specific about revealing the future about that plan, doesn't it? I mean, we don't get very far into the book that we start hearing about this Jesus Christ or this blessing, this spiritual individual who's going to come. In the Garden of Eden, we heard about him, right? Talking about the fall of man when we started getting into the punishments for Satan, for the serpent, is our first mention of that. Genesis 3, verse 27, I think. So it's introduction to the rest of the Bible. It's explanatory of the rest of the Bible because it gives us these principles that we have to carry with us as our first tools in our toolbox to understand the rest of the book. If we didn't have Genesis and we just started with Exodus and started with this nation of Israel being led out of Egypt and out of bondage by this man named Moses, what would we be missing? We wouldn't understand anything about who these people are. We wouldn't know about the promises given to Abraham or any of that. So it's explanatory to the rest of the Bible. And the rest of the Bible leans upon Genesis quite heavily. I saw this quote and I thought it was a good one. The roots of all subsequent revelation are planted in Genesis. And whoever would truly comprehend that revelation must begin here. So it's right that this is at the beginning in the Bible. All right, here's a couple of things I'd like for you to think about. Genesis is the first book in the Bible, right? Revelation is the last book in the Bible. Remember now, our primary summary of the book as a whole is there's a pattern with God. All right, let's look at some of these. Genesis answers the question, how did it all begin? Revelation answers the question, how will it all end? Genesis gives us access or shows that there's access to the tree of life and that it is lost. Genesis 3:24. Revelation talks about there is access to the tree of life through Jesus Christ. Revelation 22:14. Genesis is the beginning of sorrow and death. Chapter 3. Revelation says that there will be a time where there will be no more death. 21:4. Genesis shows us the evil triumph of the serpent over man. Revelation shows the ultimate victory over Satan by the Lamb. Genesis shows that the walk with God is interrupted by sin. Revelation shows that the walk with God can be resumed and will be resumed by the saints. A couple more here I didn't add to the slide. Genesis, we see sin in its beginnings. In Revelation, we see sin in its full development as represented by the harlot, the false prophet, the beast, and the dragon, all of the which are defeated by Jesus Christ. In Genesis, we are first given the first promise of a coming Savior. In Revelation, we see the promise of its full and glorious fulfillment. Genesis causes anticipation and anxiety. When you get through reading the book of Genesis, it's kind of a cliffhanger, isn't it? It leaves us with a lot of unanswered questions and almost a to-be-continued ... moment, right? At the end of this book, there's so much left unsaid. And when we get to Revelation, we have given to us all hope and assurance that Satan will not win, that Christ will be victorious. Again, God's pattern and God's plan. Genesis is the foundation stone of the Bible. Revelation is the capstone that's laid at the very apex to indicate completeness in this message. One is just as important as the other, folks, and everything in between. So I think maybe that's an interesting way I came across to look at Genesis as it is reflected by the other bookend, Revelation. All right, let's look at Genesis biographically for just a moment. This is one way you can study the book. You've got Abel the worshiper, Enoch the walker, he walked with God and was with not, Noah the worker. You got Abraham, the wanderer, Isaac, the watcher, Jacob, the wrestler, and then you've got Joseph, the waiter. And then, if you wanted to think on the counter side of all that, you've got Esau, Lot, and Cain. And Esau, Lot, and Cain represent what? Or could represent what? Lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. All that can be a good study and approach to looking at Genesis in a little different way. So there's a way you could study this book biographically. And I think you could look at it typically. We've done a little bit of this. We've looked at Adam as a type of Christ. Romans 5 verse 14 describes him as such. We look at the salvation of Noah. Do we ever see that in the New Testament? The salvation of Noah compared to baptism? Even so, in like manner. 1 Peter 3:21. Ishmael and Isaac typifies two covenants, much as what we need to come to understand concerning the old law and the new law. And Galatians 4 talks about that. The sacrifice of Abraham's son, of Isaac, of course, on the altar, typifies the sacrifice of God's only son. And that's over in Genesis 22 is where you'll find that reference. And we talked about also Melchizedek in the Old Testament with Abraham, was king and high priest. And Hebrews chapter 7 uses and refers to Melchizedek in trying to offer a description of, for our understanding of who Jesus Christ was. Could you understand any of this without the book of Genesis? You couldn't understand any of that because you wouldn't know who any of these people were or any of the elements that surrounded it. So understanding Genesis typically is very, very helpful. And many places in the New Testament require us to have understanding and a good knowledge of what we've been studying. So, Genesis is a theme. I mentioned that there is a pattern with God, is a summary statement for Genesis. But if I had to give it a theme, I'd have to say the divine sovereignty of God. We have to believe that God is a divine sovereign. And every single word of that is important. He is a divine sovereign. All right, and a breakdown of that is seen pretty easily in an outline. The divine sovereignty of God is showed to us. My font's so small, I can't read it. If we look at chapter 1 through 11, you see four outstanding events that bring this to light very, very readily. The creation, divine sovereignty, and the physical creation, God's eternal priority of things. We see His divine sovereignty brought about or displayed to us in the fall. In human probation is given by God. God's moral authority is established in the fall of man. Who has the right to say what is sin and what is not sin? God does. Why? Because God is holy. He is sovereign. He's sovereign because He is holy. He is divine. So do we have a right to determine and assign and write down what is sin and what is not sin? Does man have the right to do that? Nope. It's God's. What if we don't like what God says is sin and we want to change it? Is that okay? No, because He's the sovereign, not us. The flood, divine sovereignty in historical retribution, God's judicial severity. Who is the one who metes out judgment or is and will met out judgment? The sovereign does. God does. Only God does, ultimately. And then the Babel crisis, divine sovereignty and racial distribution, God's governmental supremacy. Does God rule in the hearts and minds of men and within nations? Yes, He does. Why? Because He is the divine sovereign. And He is the one bringing about His plan. And so when we look at the first 11 chapters, we see that we can consider His divine sovereignty through these outstanding events that are in the first 11 chapters. Then when we get over chapter 12 through chapter 50, there are four outstanding people. So you go from really the individual people in the first 11 chapters, while some of them are significant, they don't play the same role in the message and in the narrative than you see in the last part of the book with the four outstanding people of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. All of these are bringing out different aspects about God that God wants us to know and to understand. When we look at Abraham, we think of his supernatural call. I'm going to lead you into a land that I will show you. And the faith that is involved with Abraham is highlighted. With Isaac, this divine sovereignty of a supernatural birth. With Jacob, a supernatural care is exhibited over and over again with Jacob. And of course, with Joseph, this idea of supernatural control. All of these are aspects of Jehovah that we must understand and be aware of. And certainly, when Israel, the nation, needed to be taught who Jehovah was, it was far more than the God who issues forth plagues and gets us out of slavery. They needed to understand this of who Jehovah is. Who is it that we've been called out of Egypt to worship? Okay. If, in conclusion here, if Genesis is not true, okay, if what we've just studied is not true, the New Testament falls to the ground. Because the very scheme of redemption is predicted on the fact that God is, that man is responsible to God, that sin has entered in, and that man is in need of redemption, and that God has provided for man's redemption. People that want to question the existence of God or have doubts in their faith, or they want to throw stones at the church as just a bunch of hypocrites or misguided individuals, bring them back to these five statements and center the discussion back on this, that God is. If He's not, you've got to give me another acceptable answer to why things are what they are. That man is responsible to God. He is sovereign over us. That there is a thing as sin, which enters into the issue of morality. Where does morality come from and all that? That man is in need of redemption of one's sins. How else do I get it? Can man save himself? And that God has provided for man's redemption. And then that centers back on Jesus Christ. Those issues are what we need to focus conversations on with people. So to reject Genesis is to destroy faith in Jesus. Because He endorsed Genesis, didn't He? In Matthew chapter 19, He endorsed the books of Moses in His own teaching. So if you reject Genesis, you reject Jesus Christ and His teachings. To reject Genesis is to destroy our very birthright as human beings, created in the image of God, and consequently has placed us on a higher plane than the beasts of the field. If you reject Genesis, we're just a smarter monkey, right? Such is not the case. So I just want to say it's been a delight for me to study through this book and to try to bring things out for us each week. Maybe we've approached this in a little different way than you've ever studied the book before, but it's a real delight for me to have gone through the entire book at, I think, a pretty good pace, about as fast of a pace as you can do it justice, unless you take a very summary approach to the study. So we got just a few minutes left. I'd like to hear from you all. What does a study of this book that we've spent the last several months doing, what has it done for you? Well, this is risky as a teacher. It didn't do a thing for me. It reflects on the teacher, not the topic. What have you gained from this? What has been interesting to you or helped you in this way over the last few months? Has any of this resonated? Please say yes. What do you think? Chris?
Well, I'll admit I was somewhat skeptical about the big picture approach to this book.
Mm-hmm.
I understand it now. I accept it.
Okay,
so no problem there. I had thought it would be more detailed.
Okay.
You know, covering the verses, each verse.
Right.
That's the way I do it when I.
Right.
But now that I possess this greater knowledge, I think that it'll help in my ability to teach other people.
Oh, good. wasn't a waste of time. And I'll tell you, you know, in our private studies, we all sit and we read Scripture. And we read verse by verse by verse, we read the stories. And sometimes we don't necessarily see the connections to other places because we're just maybe not even familiar with that passage. So we've tried to highlight how some of this ties in with others. And at times, especially in the beginning, it may have felt a bit disjointed. But maybe now it's kind of all coming together for us. So I appreciate that, Chris. Really do. And your patience each week while we tried to bring that out. Good. Thank you.
Part of my skepticism was based on knowing that it was written by somebody not in the church.
Oh, the book? The commentary?
The commentary.
Yeah, I don't know if I mentioned that or not, but I used the commentary as a key source for some of this material, a lot of this material, Jim McQuiggan. And in fact, that's the title of his commentary, Genesis and Us. I just took a picture of the cover of his book and used it each week. So, you know, that was no great graphical composition of mine. Like all great preachers or lesson teachers, I stole it from somebody else. But McQuiggan is a very conservative commentator, but he is by no means sound in all issues, as most commentaries you would pull off the shelf. Okay? But he's pretty solid on Old Testament stuff, especially. The issue of essential, all elements essential to salvation. He goes a little in the ditch concerning some of that. But in the Old Testament stuff, I would recommend his commentaries as much as I could recommend anybody else's. His commentary on Daniel and Isaiah, and by the way, they're shorter. You know, they're not big, thick tomes. They're pretty short, and you can get his points. And his approach to this was very similar to the one I used in class. And I told Chris about that early on. I think he went and got a copy of it. Other thoughts about the book or maybe a specific story or something that you'd like to kind of bring back out and highlight?
I have a question.
Okay.
Is there any significance in the fact that Rachel was not buried in the cave at Machpelah?
You know, in the storyline, they were traveling when it read as though the pregnancy with Benjamin was perhaps early or unexpected when it happened. They were traveling and, you know, they went to such lengths to bury other people in Machpelah. You wonder, well, why didn't you take 30 days of mourning and walk back up there and bury her in the cave? But if you recall what had happened just prior to that, Shechem,
Remember that? With Simeon and Levi? And what did Jacob say to his sons, including those two who instigated it with Dinah? You have made us stink to the people. We've got to get out of here. And God even intervened, okay, to give them safe passage out. And now they're going to walk back with Rachel's body for burial and maybe bring the wrath not only of the people upon them, but even to desecrate even where their other ancestors were buried. Those people could have been so upset that they would have wiped out the cave and everybody already in it and to remove any presence of the Israelites, presence at all in the land.
Well, when you put it that way, it makes sense. I just thought, wow, Leah made it and Rachel didn't?
Yes. Well, I I'm not sure Jacob ever got over that. That may have been something that he held against those boys the rest of his life in the sense of, you know, how much he wanted to see Joseph again. How much did he hold on to Benjamin and not turn loose of him into the hands of his other sons? Because he knew what they were capable of doing. And so when he talks about Simeon and Levi in chapter 49 and those blessings and describes them and their hatred and their swords that are in their hands and how quick to anger they are, he could have been saying, yeah, it was so bad, I couldn't even bury Rachel where I wanted to. The love of my life, I will now not be buried next to her. There's emotion behind these events that we get to read about. And sometimes the words kind of remove us from the emotion side of that. These were real people. And I think that's probably what intervened with it. I don't have any other answer than that. Is that the God was providing for their safe passage away from the people who were so upset with them about what they had done over Dinah, that they had to leave, and they went far to the south and dwelt there.